Human Services Finance Committee will come to order. Representative Albright moves approval of the minutes from March 2nd, 2017. Any additions or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from March 2nd, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. Motion prevails. The minutes from March 2nd are adopted. We have House File 629. Representative Rarick comes to the committee. Representative Rarick, welcome to the committee. I'm going to go ahead and move House File 629 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Rarick, we have the bill before us. I see no amendments in my packet or on my list. So, Representative Rarick, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. If you recall, last year we dealt with an issue that came out of Minsure where people 55 and older had discovered that through the medical assistance program they had liens that were put against their properties anywhere from ranging from about $20,000 to some over $50,000. And we worked on a way to fix that, to relieve them of that lien. There were a couple of little technical changes, some dates that needed to be gotten rid of so they could go back further to alleviate those liens. So this bill will fix that and get us up where we wanted to be with helping these people out.
Thank you, Representative Rarick. I believe Rick Rayburn from Willow River, Minnesota is here to testify. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Rayburn. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Dean, Mr. Chairman, the committee. I'm Rick Rayburn from Willow River, Minnesota. I'm here in support of HF 629. Passage of this bill will finalize the legislation, removing Minnesota's statute that requires for anyone receiving medical assistance at the age of 55 and over that the state must recover all costs from that person's estate. The Affordable Care Act and the expansion of Medicaid required that vast numbers of Americans with modest incomes and unbounded assets accept the Medicaid program. In Minnesota, this lien clawback, as it's called, was not disclosed. It was also not prevented, even though the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services had urged the states to ensure that this group not be subject to estate recoveries when enrolled under the Affordable Care Act. So those signing up had no idea that they were depleting their estates for many thousands or tens of thousands of dollars per year. So this this was not affordable care, health care. HF 629 is a step in the direction of affordable health care, as it does not require the heirs pay the cost of their benefactor's basic health care through the loss of their inheritance. This income group has the resources to benefit their heirs, and it is this group that the unfortunate combination of the estate liens, the expansion of Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act specifically targeted. A few notes on regarding this 55 recovery clause, or clawback as it's called. This situation is not unique to Minnesota. The lien clawback is a nationwide option. It can be implemented by any state at any time and be retroactive in effect. Thus, Medicaid expenses paid for anyone at the age 55 and over, regardless of when, could at some time be recovered. The sad truth is this, that as the millions of Americans that will make up the Medicaid expansion group celebrate their 55th birthday, each and every one will start accumulating potential liens against their estates. A recovery agent once told me that Medicaid has always been a pay-for program. As long as legislation like the 55 lien recovery policy is allowed, Medicaid can always be a pay-for program. The Affordable Care Act should have been more flexible. A program allowing those with resources to pay reduced rates should have been offered to this income group. Passage of HF 629 gives Minnesotans reprieve for now. However, as long as someone somewhere can allow the Department of Human Services to tabulate and collect on these claims, the shadow of reoccurring estate liens will remain. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Rayburn. Questions for the testifier? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to testify, order Representative Rarick.
I'm not really clear on, and I know we did this before, and could you just be a little more clear on what this does that we didn't do before? I'm just not really sure how this is changing what we already did to fix the situation.
Okay, what was, if I may?
Yes, Mr. Raven.
Thank you. The legislation that was passed and signed into law by Governor Dayton last session, that removed the liens going back to January 1st, 2014. And everything beyond that, into the future, the state of Minnesota would not have been able to collect for, or would not. And at this time, the Department of Human Services is not collecting on liens. However, the legislation, that was subject to federal approval. And it was the DHS in Minnesota sent the state plan amendment to CMS in Chicago, and they responded that they were not quite satisfied with what Minnesota was doing with their state plan amendment for the Department of Human Services. So they sent back and said, we want you to remove the liens going back, you know, to the beginning, whenever they were established. So basically that goes beyond 2014. And that's what this legislation does. It does not it does not have a date, a backtrack date. It merely says that the state of Minnesota can no longer collect for anything other than long-term care. So any basic health care is not going to be recovered by the Department of Human Services as it stands now. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Leland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then that being the case, thank you for that explanation. I would expect there to be an additional cost that would be reflected in the fiscal note, and I'm not really understanding why there isn't. I mean, I haven't had a chance to read the text, but maybe somebody could explain that.
Representative Liebling, Mr. Byrd could maybe answer that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, there actually is a cost difference between what we passed last year and what happens here. In my understanding, it's around $100,000. It's prior to 2014. The date was the issue that CMS had. We couldn't treat some people one way, some states one way, and others another way. This is, you'll see the date on this is 3-1. The forecast that came out this week assumes what we meant to do last year, which was to do it. And so as of the forecast, it's factored in, and this bill has no cost to the forecast, if that's clear.
Okay, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Byrd. Thank you, Mr. Byrd. That is very helpful. And so, you know, since I have the floor, I just want to make a couple of comments about this, if I could. And yeah, I remember that hearings last year, I think it was, and you know, I think that all of us agreed that there was a problem and that we needed to fix it, and I'm glad that we were able to do it. And I think that from my point of view, maybe it's a little different than some about what the problem was. I think the problem was that people weren't made aware and that they really didn't have a choice to not get medical assistance as opposed to something else. But the testifier made a couple comments that I just want to kind of put a different spin on this. You know, before the ACA, a lot of these people might have been unable to buy insurance or might have bought insurance that still left them financially exposed. So when we talk about it being sort of unfair for their heirs to pay for it, I guess I don't agree with that. I want to be really clear. I'm glad we fixed the problem because I do think it was done wrong. It wasn't fair for people to get hit with something they weren't aware of up front. I don't think we ever should have treated people over 55 differently than other people. So there were a lot of problems with it, and I'm not defending that piece of it. But I do just want to say that I don't think it's unfair to collect from people's estates money that the public has paid for their care while they were alive. I mean, we do this in long-term care. It's a way to make sure that people are able to have assets to live on while they're alive. And so if it's, I guess I just don't have the sense that that a person's really entitled to assets that the public, when the public spends money on somebody, a lot of money, I don't think it's really unfair for the public to ask to have that collected after their death. But again, I want to make it really clear. I'm not saying this was the right thing to do. I was glad that we have fixed it in the past. I'm happy to vote for the bill because we need to really clean it up, so no problem there. The other thing I just wanted to mention is that, Representative Rarick, when you introduced the bill, you made a misstatement that I just want to correct, and I don't mean to be critical of you because I know this isn't even an area that you're really, you know, this, you're not serving on these committees anyway, but I want to mention this because it's a really common mistake that people are making all the time, and that is to say that this came out of Minsher. Minsher is the marketplace. This is an ACA thing. It came out of, it's Medicaid. The only connection with Minsher is that's the front door where people signed up. But it's not, this problem wasn't created by Minsher at all. And I just want to make that really clear, just because that is such confusing terminology to everybody. So I'm not singling out you, but because we're in a public forum, I want to be really clear. This was under Medicaid. It was a result of the ACA. It was a, you know, one of those glitches that we're just now sorting it out, but not related to Minsher at all. So thank you.
All right. Other questions for the testifier or for Representative Albright? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the point that Representative Liebling just made, I think that there needs to be further clarification that the situation that arises, as Representative Rarick and the testifier bring up, did occur as part of the application process as people went on to the Minsher site. And because of their application to Medicare, this is what occurred. Even though there was nominal disclosure, it was in type that was either, you know, so small or in, you know, eclectic nature that it wasn't really fully disclosed. So I just want to make the record clear that it was through Minsher, it was through the application process. That's how we got where we are today.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Mr. Rayburn, thank you for coming back to testify again, and I hope that when you come back again, it'll be to tour the Capitol and to visit your representative and not to testify on this issue. So thank you for coming back again, and apologies for all of your extra work on this particular issue.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and the committee.
All right. Final thoughts, Representative Rurick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say, you know, thank you to Mr. Rayburn and his group that did so much work and were the ones who kind of brought this all out. It's because of them that we were able to do this and get this fixed. So I appreciate your support.
Thank you for your work on this, Representative Rarick. Representative Rarick renews his motion. I will renew my motion that House File 629 be laid over, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those no. House File 629 is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Rarick. Representative Rarick, I will move House File 630 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. We have the bill before us. There's also a DE1 amendment. I will move the DE1 amendment, Representative Rarick, to that amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill that we have been working on with a number of groups, and there's been some long, long discussions. The DE1 amendment is to put the bill into the language that is in the governor's bill at this time. And this is dealing with the reimbursing counties for child placement that are covered under the ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act. There are going to continue to be more discussions. We do have another amendment that we will talk about, but the DE1 is the one that we want to adopt and move out with today.
All right. Thank you, Representative Eric. All those in favor of adoption of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Eric to House File 630 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will leave most of this testimony up to the testifiers. They can say it much better. Again, we've been working with a number of groups. We have some little tweaks we're probably going to be discussing in a meeting here next week. But This is really important. I believe we'll get some information here from the testifier explaining just the situation that we're in the state of Minnesota and how the burden that's on our counties for child placement. And this is just one step to try to help our counties be relieved of some of that burden. So I will turn it over to the testifiers.
All right, welcome to the committee, Mr. Ungauer. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm John Ungauer, Government and Relations Director for St. Louis County. This bill, as Representative Ware said, is an effort to provide property tax relief to a number of counties who have a disproportionate share of the cost of primarily the Indian Child Welfare Act. And it was a provision that was in the omnibus tax bill last year, which, as you all know, did pass the legislature at least. And so we are, again this year, trying to get the provision back in the tax bill and hopefully get it passed and signed into law this year. The situation analysis is this. Of the 50 states in the United States, Minnesota ranks 49th out of the 50 when it comes to the state sharing in the cost of child protection. Now, this bill obviously deals with just one facet of child protection, the Indian Child Welfare Act. But because Minnesota has such a disparity amongst its counties when it comes to where the Native American children are living, primarily in the northern counties and certain other parts of the state, there's about 20 counties that have a real high cost on the property taxes when it comes to providing these services. In fact, it is so high that on a per capita basis, some of these counties are paying eight times more per capita than other counties are on property taxes to deliver and pay for these services. So we are basically just looking for relief, property tax relief. That's why this was in the tax bill last year rather than in the omnibus Health and Human Services Appropriations Bill. And when this bill was heard in Policy Committee, there was some concerns from DHS about some policy language, and that is what Representative Ware is referring to, is that we've been working with a number of the stakeholders to try to get this bill in shape so that it can be moved forward. As Representative Ware mentioned, we will be having a meeting in the next week or so. The Department of Revenue is calling a meeting because they also have this provision in the governor's tax bill right now, and they want to make sure that the Department of Revenue fully understands what Department of Human Services concerns are, because they don't quite understand what Department of Human Services concerns are either. Meanwhile, we did meet with Representative Allen and Representative Schultz this week, too, to talk over some other possibilities on how to address some of the concerns we think DHS has. So we're very encouraged that in the near future we'll be able to get those groups together and work out the differences and concerns that DHS has. Thank you.
All right. And Representative Rarick, you have an A2 amendment, which is just some technical cleanup language. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that we did draft that. That is what some of the department language that they wanted us to look at. I wanted to bring that forward so members could see that, but we do not wish to adopt that language.
Okay, we will not be taking up the A2 amendment at this time. Let's see. Mr. Copley, would you like to come down? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Jim Koppel. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Children and Family Services at the Department of Human Services. Our principal concern with the bill is the A2 amendment would address. So I didn't know. I thought we were moving that forward today as well. Here's the situation that makes this so important to talk about. We have 18 times more Native American children in placement in foster care than white children. That's the highest disparity in the country. There's two ways that children get placed, Native American children get placed. They get placed through tribal court or they get placed through state court. What this amendment would do would limit the placement payments, reimbursement to counties, for those placements made in tribal court. So the way that works now is a case, child protection case, gets pulled into tribal court at the request of the tribe, of the court, and or of the family, or the county may work with the tribe to transfer it. When it gets transferred into court, and the tribal court makes a decision that there's a placement, the county is held responsible for those payments. This would address those payments and reimburse the county proportionately for those payments. If it's made in state court, the way the bill is written, it would also pay for those. We don't pay, we don't reimburse the county for a determination of foster care in state court for any race, any population right now. There's a federal share, and then there's the county share. The state doesn't participate. If we are going to start paying for Native children to be placed in foster care when we already have the highest disparity in the country of placements for Native children, I think you can begin to see what my concern is that we are reinforcing a bad behavior and not addressing it from the front end, which would to cut those placements as opposed to reimburse for those placements. So I just want to call your attention to the importance of that issue. And from a, from a equity vantage point, from a disparity vantage point, it's a big issue, and we need to address it, and we need to work on it. We have a pilot project going in St. Louis County right now to try to look at why those placements, how we could decrease those placements, how we could work to improve the system, but we can't allow a tax policy bill to inadvertently impact our child welfare policy. And that's what our concern is, and that's why we have been working with Representative Rarick and why we think it's so important to move forward the A2 amendment that was drafted for today, and that was drafted by the department for that specific reason.
Thank you, Mr. Kopp, or Commissioner. Is there questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm just wondering, with the number of out-of-home placements that we have in that are going on, do you know what's the number one cause of them?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's certainly one of the highest drivers in recent years has been the opioid epidemic that we have in Minnesota and the number of children born into dependency so I would say it varies over time as to leading causes, but that's one of the leading causes currently.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, it's not just the opioids. I've worked the reservations as a narcotics officer. There is a huge drug problem, not just on the reservations, all over the state. In my county, the number one cause, in fact, the only cause for out-of-home placements to kids was drugs and drug abuse. It's a major issue that we have to deal with. I want to thank Representative Rorick for bringing this forward, because you've got to remember, on these reservations, they're not paying property taxes. And this is a way for the state to help out those counties for that high cost of out-of-home placement for a part of the community and that county that aren't paying property taxes to pay for this.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I have some, like,
procedural questions and process questions about where this is moving and what committees are going to be reviewing this and the reasons for not presenting the amendment this time, questions as to why we can get an explanation. But first of all, I address that the ICWA was adopted by Congress in 1978, and these high out-of-home placement rates predate much of what you're talking about, the drug epidemic. And so it's probably increased the and that there's a greater need for services and for to keep kids in homes. And the property tax issue, I mean, there are tribes that pay their members pay for the foster care services if they have the means to. And so there's a federal share, and then there is a tribal share too. And I don't know that we even like address that in here. That we make sure that that's not that they're not being reimbursed for in those cases where there is a significant tribal share payment. So and tribes and tribal members pay taxes. They all pay federal taxes, pay sales taxes the same rate as everyone else. And they probably pay more because much of our excise, everything is regressive, so they pay a larger share proportion than we probably do. So the ICWA purpose, we talk about out-of-home placement and the highest rate. We have a very little understanding of the purpose of in our own statute when we incorporate the federal mandate, and it is to preserve the Indian family, including in tribal identity, and including an understanding that Indian children are damaged if family and child tribal identity and contact are denied. So if you this act, we talk about active efforts. And so active efforts is actually the longest part of the statute. And these active efforts are a duty to prevent out-of-home placement, to promote family reunification. And active efforts are something that no court can order an out-of-home placement unless the agency demonstrates, provides evidence, and the court finds that the local social services agency made active efforts to the Indian child's family. And one of the criteria for determining whether active efforts have been made is for the local services agency to demonstrate that they have provided concrete services and access to both tribal and non-tribal services to members of the Indian child's family, including but not limited to financial assistance, food, housing, health care, transportation, in-home services, community support services, and specialized services, and whether these services are being provided in an ongoing manner throughout the agency's involvement with the family, to directly assist the family in assessing and utilizing services to maintain the Indian family or reunify the Indian family as soon as safely can be assured if out-of-home placement has occurred. So, and that was sort of, you know, we're not the ones to fix this. I mean, I think part of the reason for slowing this down is that we have an Indian Advisory Council that's legislatively commissioned to address, and that's with tribes and urban organizations to advise the legislature. And then it takes time for, I mean, this wasn't a tax policy. And so, you know, tribes are focused on, it usually comes through health and human services. So it takes time. And so part of, like, we were trying to do is slow this down so that we could get tribes input, county input, social, all the stakeholders that you are now becoming very familiar with. And so I appreciate that you have really been open to slowing this down and to hearing from all stakeholders. And that I think that's part of the reason why the amendment, the delay, is that you want to get input, because one of the options that the tribes has presented was that we tie it to compliance. So there has to be a demonstration of compliance with ICWA with these active efforts, the lengthy provision I read, that they would have to demonstrate compliance, and if they did not comply, that they would lose the funding. And so, and that has been something that tribal advocates have been complained about, and a lot of work's been done in the courts with judges as well, because there is not
there is not consistent compliance with ICWA in our county courts, with our judges, within county social services. And that is a huge part of the problem, why the placement, out-of-home places 18 times, is compliance. I mean, not alone a lack of funds to fund. I mean, we're moving to a tribal model where tribes are having more success, and when they have the funds, we have a state grant program for to do that. It's capped at $100,000, but they use those funds to provide social services, family-based services to keep the family intact, prevention. And so my idea was, let's tie it to these support services, and not, because the advocates, our first initial reaction was there's something, you can't provide an incentive, use a tax code, something that we're trying to reduce. So we're working on improving tribal services, and we're working on bringing those out-of-home placements down so that the counties do not have this burden, and tribes recognize that and understand that and want to work with counties. But it should be tied somehow to supportive services. But the tribe's idea of making it compliance, all those are good policy, you know, that kind of taking this, even though it's a tax bill, looking at the policy of ICWA and trying to incorporate. And that's what DHS is doing. That's what now the tribes are doing. And so you could explain, Representative Rager, a little bit more about the process and where this is going.
Representative Rager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Allen. The next stop will be taxes for this bill. And part of what the commissioner brought up some great points, we know on that, and we've got another testifier who wants to talk about some other points that were brought up. These are all issues that we're working on, because we want this bill to be in the right shape. The reason I took on the DE amendment, that was the governor's language, and was actually very close to the intent that I had when I originally was going to submit the bill. Again, I'll admit this isn't my area that I am well versed in, and so I believe it was because of that that I got some things wrong with the revisor's office. So that's, I really appreciated at our first committee hearing all the input. We have a lot of things that we know we need to address, but I believe this meeting that we're hoping takes place next week will really bring some people together, and we'll know if we're going to go through with the department's amendment or any of the others. There were two others that were also submitted, but I think we felt moving out of here today with the governor's language was the best step. Have some more discussions, and then any other changes that need to be made, we could do in property tax or in taxes.
Bring it back here.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to say thank you, Representative Allen, for helping me understand it a little bit better. I mean, that's one of my concerns, and I reached out at the beginning of the session, and I invited the executive director from all the affairs councils to come in and sit with me and help me understand issues as it pertains to their area of expertise. And I would encourage all legislators to do that if you haven't already. And so thank you for that explanation. I'd also like to say thank you, Representative Rarick, for putting the brakes on a little bit to where you can fully understand this as well. And if there's ever a time when an issue like this comes before us that in this case affects with Indian Affairs, the Native Americans, the tribes, it would be very, very helpful as a legislator if there was a representative, that somebody that would come down and commented also, that would represent Indian Affairs. That would be very beneficial as a legislator. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. And procedurally, this will be headed next to civil law and data practices. So, sorry, you got one more stop. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to recommend that it come back to this committee after you meet with the interest groups and finalize another amendment, if there's going to be some policy changes or finance structure changes.
Representative Schultz, there is a minimal fiscal cost to this. Most of that cost will be from taxes, I believe, so that the revenue will be in that direction. But we will give everyone an updated fiscal note or anything else in terms of how this is going to be, the cost of this as it moves forward. We have not received that, but from what I understand, it's relatively small. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so if it's going to civil, I mean, that civil has dealt with this issue extensively, so that would be good. Or if there's time to even, like, go back to reform, mm-hmm. That would make a lot of sense as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. With that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 630 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All those in favor, please say aye.
We have another testifier.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do we have another testifier?
Yeah.
We're going to have to move very quickly because we have three more bills and we have one more hour. So please, if you could, make your way to the testifier table. Apologize for that. But please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Dean, and committee. My name is Stephen Holland, and I'm honored to be here. I'm a county commissioner in Pine County. I know Representative Rarick from when he was a student of mine years ago. So I'm proud of him for being here and for carrying this bill. I'll try to be brief, but just some points. We are proud in Pine County that we have made a conscious effort to meet with the Mille Lacs Band, and we do that on a monthly basis and try to touch base on a lot of areas, and we have signed a memorandum of understanding with them, stated some principles. You can look on our website. I won't read them all to you, but some of the guiding principles we have is that all children deserve to have access to a safe home. All persons deserve to have access to safe and affordable housing. And all persons suffering from substance abuse deserve to have access to adequate treatment facilities. That's just three of our 18 policies that we've come up with. I would encourage and invite all of you folks to come to one of our, we call them an annual summit that we have with our elected officials and the tribal elected officials, and we discuss issues, and we have a team from our county that meets with their counterparts from the tribe with probation, health and human services, our sheriff, our county attorney. They meet often and are trying to get at the front end of some of these issues that we have because we just show up on the back end. And if I could just indulge the committee for a second, we obviously support this bill, and from the reason, one of the reasons is that we're a small county with a small tax base. We collect about $15.5 million in property taxes, so the $470,000 bill that it costs us just for ICWA bills that come to us represents about 3% of our entire levy, and 85 to 95% of all of our ICWA cases are heard in tribal court. So none of our county social workers have a thing to do with that at all. The only thing we see is the bill, and we submit a check. So $470,000 that's a huge item to us. I will not. I know you're pressed for time. I won't take any more of your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Appreciate that. Apologies for before. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed the representative from the Red Lake Nations here, and I was kind of wondering if she had some any input she'd like to share.
Anybody from the audience who wishes to testify for or against the bill is welcome to do so. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tony Stilley. I'm an ambassador for the Red Lake Nation, and I appreciate you offering me the opportunity to speak on behalf of the Red Lake Nation. What I'm going to offer you today is a letter from Chairman Siki that was sent to Senator Abler. I'm sorry, I wasn't prepared for this, but I'll pull it up real quick. And we actually opposed the bill with the current language because of the broadness of the language, and we actually support also the putting some measures, stopgap measures in there so that we don't want to see our children just being placed and not, you know, there not being any type of stopgap measures for those placements. So what I can do is I can email your committee administrator the letter that Chairman Siki sent with Senator Abler, and if you have any questions, I can try to answer those questions.
That would be great. We'd appreciate it, and we will make sure that everyone on the committee is forwarded a copy of the letter that you'd send.
Okay.
Appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. And if you would, please just check in with Paige and leave your name for our committee notes. Thanks. Anyone else would like to testify for or against this bill? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Bill Haas. I represent Writers Tribal Nation. And we had an amendment that was withdrawn today, which is fine because we need some time to work on with Representative Rarick and the other members, the counties and that, on the language. But Writers concerned because they want some additional provisions put in this. One, they want the counties that are claiming the non-federal share reimbursement must demonstrate upon review of the case that they have achieved substantial conformity with the Indian Child Welfare Act, the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, and the Tribal State Agreement. Two, there shall be a review panel identified by the Department of Human Services, Ombudsman for the Indian Families, and the Tribal ICW Advisory Council that provides continuous review of these cases that are claimed by the counties for their non-federal share of reimbursement, and that the panel reviews costs would be reimbursed by DHS, and then any cases that are found that are non-compliant with the Indian Child Welfare Act, the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, and the Tribal State Agreement must be reimbursed to the Department of Revenue. So we look forward to working with the interested parties to get conforming language that everybody can agree with. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Appreciate that. All right. Final thoughts, Mr. Rarick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would appreciate your support. We'll continue to work with Representative Allen and keep everybody informed so that we get the correct changes made and get this the way it needs to be.
I will move that House File, renew my motion that House File 630 as amended be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. All right, thank you, Representative Rarick. Next up we have Representative Baker. Representative Baker, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 872 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us. I understand you have a DE1 amendment. We will take up the DE1 immediately. Representative Baker to the DE1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. The DE amendment just kind of cleans up what we're looking for. Basically, the 5% and then the 2.5% each year for the next 3 years after that kind of just firms things up. So that's really the intent of that amendment, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to accept that if I could.
All those in favor of adoption of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Baker, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, today we bring to you the folks that are here around the state of Minnesota that are helping their citizens trying to get back their lives. These are the folks that are literally taking in people that are at their bottom, and they are coming in the door. They are broken, they're busted, they're probably jobless, and they're in trouble. And these are the folks that I call heroes around Minnesota, and they have not had an increase in the last 10 years, actually the last 8 years, except we did get a small increase in 2015. I'm grateful that I was a part of that small change. We got a 2% increase then. What's happening is the complexities are getting much more in-depth, and today, members, I've got a couple testifiers to share their stories, and would appreciate your support on this today. So, Mr. Chair, I turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Baker. And to the testifiers, if the testifiers could please make their way down to the testifier table and please proceed in whatever order you would like. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, sir.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Baker. My name is Mike Schicks. I'm representing the Minnesota Alliance of Rural Addiction Treatment Providers. I'm also the executive director of Project Turnabout, a rural nonprofit center in four locations, and did testify 2 years ago on behalf of the 2% increase. I've been in the field for 37 years, 26 at Hazleton and 11 years at Project Turnabout, and I represent the people that are in recovery and the recovery and the people that need help in the future. I happen to be in recovery 40 years, one day at a time, from alcohol drugs. So I bring that perspective to this. We support this field because it's vital. The field is fragile. In 2015, when we testified, we were under the understanding that in 2017 there would be the year of chemical dependency treatment, is what we were told with from Human Services. Now it looks like those increases are going to 2019 and 2020. And frankly, we just can't keep doing it anymore. 42 centers have not renewed their license in the last year, 12 from the rural areas. Detoxification centers are closed. We're losing ground. To give you an example, Project Turnabout, our facility for the most severe patients, which is a large number of people that we have, over 100 beds. In 2008, we received, today we received $3.95 a day more than we did in 2008. Now that is an all-inclusive rate. That includes everything. That includes if you need drug tests, you need psychiatric coverage. There are no ancillary charges with that. If there needs to be transportation in a rural area, we do it. And the Rural Association essentially came together desperate because of this, because centers are going to close, which is difficult when we see headlines about record numbers of years for behavioral health profits in one segment or another, or unused funds. And we just want to be here to help. That's what we got into this for. Excuse me if I sound passionate about this. I couldn't be more passionate about something than I am. During that period of time, we've taken on expenses, reinterpretations of licensing regulations that required more staff, electronic medical records that were required over these years, electronic billing systems, all had costly systems involved, and a patient population that increasingly gets more complex. Not only do we have the opiate issue, we have record numbers of methamphetamines, similar to when we were moved as a state to put certain antihistamines behind the pharmacist counter because people were making methamphetamines, and the methamphetamines are just as high at this time. At any given time, I have 30 days wait list. At the same time, knowing that we don't know from year to year where a staff increase is going to come from, and we have to increase them because there's a labor shortage for licensed addiction counselors. The recruiting costs continue to go up. We don't have things like loan forgiveness to attract people and all those kind of things. So we're sitting out there just trying to do the best we can. What we see is headlines that treatment doesn't work or whatever, which is nonsense. Treatment works. It's just that the people that are in successful recovery don't make the headlines. They don't make the headlines, the people. I never made the headlines in my recovery. There's people, we get alumni associations all across the state. So in the midst of this is more to me than just a bill. This is a potential survival for some programs. Fergus Falls closes its detox center, so now they come. Some of the state downsized beds so they could make available federal funds to offer $200 more than us, and then called us up and said, by the way, can you take the surplus? The lower rate. So
Those are the kinds of things we're facing, and I used to be perhaps a little bit more polite, but we need help. And that's what this bill is, and I thank Representative Baker for being a champion of this. But this isn't what comes natural to us. It doesn't come natural to me to talk to a group like this. And some of you I've talked to before, over the last couple of years, trying to say, hello, 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 this is coming upon us. But now is the time, and I appreciate any help you can get.
Thank you, Mr. Schicks. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Lane Elmer. Thank you for having me. I'm the CEO of New Beginnings. We are a treatment organization serving rural Minnesotans. I'm also on the board of MARCH, another industry trade association that they asked me to come here and participate today. So, like Mike said, we're in the middle of an epidemic. All of you see the news. And in addition to everything that Mike said, this is not just a societal issue, this is a financial one. Time and time again, studies show that addiction, when left untreated, costs states and taxpayers a lot of money through crime, the judicial system, incarceration, unnecessary ER visits, detox, on and on and on. We've heard a little bit more about that earlier today in some other testimonies. And while the ROI benefits are a little bit different by study, they're all on the very, very good end. The lowest that I've seen is a 4-to-1 ratio return on investment for treatment. Others have shown 7-to-1, and the most recent published by the National Institute of Health shows a 12-to-1 return investment on treatment for those suffering from addiction. 12-to-1. So despite those very high ROIs, like Mike was saying, programs are struggling, and programs like New Beginnings and many others, when we look at our forecasts, are 1 to 3 years away from being in the severe red, if not this year. So when we come to you this year, we don't have the time to wait for another budget cycle to get pretty small rate increases that we're asking for in this bill. And I know that your committee is tasked with solving some much larger healthcare issues, and reining in costs is not only a priority of yours, but a necessity. And we feel that investments in treatment of addiction will facilitate your goals in reducing overall state expenditures. Because by spending the necessary funds on treatment, you reduce expenditures in other areas of incarceration and crime and unemployment and et cetera. So we believe that this bill is the right thing to do, and we believe it's a smart thing to do. And we thank you in advance for your support.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Other testifiers? Do we have, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Baker for the bill, and Mr. Schicks, nice to see you. I just want to make sure you heard on the record my support for this. We had a nice visit in Wilmer. Your passion there and here is clear, and the urgency around this issue for you and for Project Turnabout is clear. And we know that we have a big job in front of us as a committee and as a legislature to balance the needs of those that are coming before this committee. So I just want you to know that I, among others, will be advocating to make sure that we make progress on this issue this year. All right? Thank you.
Thank you. Other testifiers? All right. Questions for members? All right, seeing none, final thoughts, Representative Baker?
Mr. Chair, members, this is a big ask. I know this is a heavy lift for us. We have a lot of folks out there that need our help, and as I, on my other legislation, work towards trying to help the addiction on the front end, try to do some less prescribing and more awareness and very important legislation, I think, on that end, we still need to save the people that are in full-blown addiction mode. And these are the folks right now that are doing the very best they can, and they're doing the very best with what they have. And I think they're not asking for a wish list here. They're asking to just maintain to make sure they have the doors open. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I really am grateful for your support.
Thank you, Representative Baker. And with that, House File 872, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in our Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you, testifiers, for coming down today and for your good work. Representative McDonald is next. Welcome to the committee, Representative McDonald. Always good to see you. You have two bills before us.
Yes.
Take them in any order you like.
Thank you very much, Chair Dean and members. I will, since in the sensitivity of time, I'll shorten my discussion to 7 pages instead of 10 in my opening statement. So for some of the, for the better half of the members, you've heard this in the reform committee in which I sit on. So anyway, my bill, 711, is a bill that provides the state's federally qualified health care centers, otherwise known as FQHCs, an increase to the health center appropriations for the Minnesota Department of Health. It's a $2 million ask for 2017 and a $2 million ask for 18. And although that seems like a lot of money, I'll show you some evidence that this will save the state millions of dollars. The state's 17 federally qualified health care centers serve about 175,000 low-income Minnesotans at over 70 delivery sites. These sites are located throughout greater Minnesota and the inner cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. I had the great honor a few weeks ago to visit the Open Cities Center just a few blocks down from the Capitol, in which Jim Platten gave me the full tour. It's a wonderful facility, and they're doing great work in coordinating the care for those, the population. So the FQHCs provides primary medical care, dental, and behavioral health care services all in, under one roof. You all here know it as coordinated care. You're also aware that in doing so, it is patient-centered and can save the state millions of dollars from emergency room visits. Health centers have proven their value in the health care system. And, for example, the FQHCs Integrated Health Partnership, as I had mentioned, reduced emergency room visits by 28%, which saved the taxpayers over $18 million. That's a wonderful, wonderful feat, and it's not an easy task, indeed. Today with me is Jonathan Watson from the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers and Dr. Roshana Preskios from Neighborhood Health Centers. I didn't say that last name correct, but I got the first name right. She's a doctor, and she's doing great great work as well, and they'll have just a few moments to testify. So with that, Mr. Chair, I turn it back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and before we do that, I'll go ahead and move the A1 amendment that be to be adopted. All those in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye. Those opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative McDonald, to your bill as amended. And first up, we will have Mr. Watson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record, and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. My name is Jonathan Watson. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. I represent the state's 17 FQHCs. Obviously, in great support of House File 711, and we do thank Representative McDonald for bringing forth this bill and to this committee for hearing it today. The first section of the bill is for low-income seniors, the 3,800 what we call dual-eligible enrollees we serve. These are low-income seniors who are eligible for Medicaid due to their income and eligible for Medicare due to their age. What this bill proposes to do is give FQHCs a choice whether they have their Medicaid or their Medicare rate for their reimbursement for these encounters that they have. Again, roughly 3,800 individuals the dually eligible individuals use a health center every year. We've had some conversations with the Department of Human Services on this. We're working forward with them. There's some operational issues and some IT build-out issues from DHS that they've expressed to me and Representative McDonald. So we just need to continue moving forward with them in the discussions on this, how to overcome this barrier. So just want to make you all aware of that. But at the heart of the bill is the health center appropriation. It is a $2 million increase. I will just briefly tell you how we spend the dollars. I'll give you some examples. First and foremost, we expanded some mobile dental services outside of Rochester in greater Minnesota, expanded hours at nearly all of our health centers for mental health and dental services. One of the projects actually increased colorectal screening among some of their patients nearly 35%, and these funds really helped assist that. And then lastly, there's been some co-location of mental health and medical services with partners in the communities as well. In an effort for transparency, how we would spend a $2 million increase, we kind of bucket it into four areas. Increased dental services, increased behavioral health services, additional care coordination. We've learned a lot of the power of care coordination for our patients. And then lastly, investments into data analytics. Playing in this healthcare reform space really requires of us to understand where our patients are going outside the four walls of our health center and which ones are at risk for emergency room use. So I'm happy to provide further detail on the identified projects that my members have come to me. However, at this time, I do want to turn it over to Dr. Price-Ozak from Neighborhood Health Source to really give you a perspective on the front lines of what these dollars can do.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Rice-Issett. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Roshana Price-Issett. I am a family physician and medical director at Neighborhood Health Source Community Clinics. I'm here today away from busy patient care in support of this bill 711. Thank you, Representative McDonald, for bringing this bill forward. So Neighborhood Health Source, or NHS, we are an FQHC, or Federally Qualified Health Center. We have three clinic sites that have been serving North Minneapolis and Northeast Minneapolis for 47 years. We serve some of the poorest patients in those communities with some of the highest health disparities. Out of our 9,000 patients serviced last year, 90% of them are at income levels below 200% of poverty. 30% of our patients have no insurance. 50% of our patients are on Medicaid. And many more of our patients are underinsured, unable to afford care due to high deductibles. Given these financial barriers, as well as language, culture, ethnicity, health literacy, many of our patients are not seeking needed primary care. They wait until their conditions or their illnesses are in crisis and they present to emergency care, which you know is extremely expensive. Had they been treated at our center ahead of time, we could have prevented expensive, unnecessary care. So over the last 4 years, our clinic, as well as 9 other FQHCs, have been in a demonstration project with DHS. And we've created our own ACO, or Accountable Care Organization. And we have decreased emergency room visits by 20%, saving the state's Medicaid program about almost $20 million. How did we do this? We did this through robust care coordination, education, and outreach. We were able to redirect 33,000 of our Medicaid patients to receive the best care at the best time, leading to more appropriate care at less expensive cost. So we need to and want to build upon this success through the demonstration project so that we can expand it to all of our patients, not just those with Medicaid. So care coordination is still needed. It's still very critical, and we would use these dollars to maintain and increase care coordination services and other services. Just to give you a really simple example of an easy patient that we helped, mid-morning Friday afternoon, I had an ultrasound report come across my desk of an abnormal ultrasound on a Spanish-speaking patient, and it indicated that the patient may need to be delivered immediately. So I went to the nurse care coordinator, who got the patient access coordinator, who was also Spanish-speaking, and the patient was called on the phone. We scheduled her an appointment to see the specialist immediately. She said she could not go to the appointment because she didn't have transportation. So using some of the funding set aside for patient with transportation issues, we got a cab to her house, got her to the hospital. The specialist recommended she get delivered right away. Well, the patient declined and went home. Our staff immediately said, well, we're sure she didn't understand the specialist. So our care coordinator and our bilingual staff called the patient. After hours, we kept calling until we reached her. They were able to explain what the specialist could not explain. And the patient said, oh, well, my husband is home. I will go to the hospital immediately. This patient had a successful delivery with no low birth weight outcomes, no expensive NICU stays, and we helped her. So that's a simple example of how care coordination can help. We have many more examples of patients with multiple chronic conditions, language barriers, literacy problems, etc., that we are helping through this care coordination. If we don't continue our funding or increase our funding, we will come to a standstill. Our jobs are not getting easier, they're getting more complex and more difficult and more demanding. Thank you for your time. I'll answer any questions you have.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Price-Issouk. Is there questions from the, are there questions from the members? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not for the testifiers, and if this is out of order, let me know, but Mr. Watson mentioned that they're working with DHS, and I'm just wondering if there's somebody from DHS that could share with us their concerns so we understand them.
All right, fair enough. Is there anybody from the department who'd like to come down? Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Marquardt. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Julie Marquardt. I'm with DHS. As Mr. Watson indicated, we have been working with the FQHCs on this particular provision in the bill. And the concerns, and I know we have expressed them, are that I guess there's several concerns. Number one is just the integration of a Medicare payment and a Medicaid payment. The nature of what Medicare pays for in an encounter rate is entirely different than what Medicaid includes in their bundled payment. So for us to actually pay correctly, it is an unbundling of the Medicare payment and then rebundling it into our payment, which on the one hand, there's probably a philosophical discussion that could be had about whether or not it should be Medicaid payments that are supplementing the Medicare program if they're not providing sufficient funding for FQHCs. But that's kind of a secondary question that I think has been out there. But from an operational standpoint, to get a claim system to do that, when the services are coded differently, it's a code that is specific to Medicare that we do not recognize as a Medicaid covered service. So to get the claim system to actually appropriately adjudicate these claims would be extremely costly. The estimate I know is well over 2 years to build. And then there's always been a historical amount of confusion, I think, amongst the clinics in validating whether or not they've been appropriately paid. We've had a history, and if you recall, about 2 years ago, we carved out all of the payments to make them directly from DHS so that at least we could have more visibility and accountability for making sure the FQHCs were paid correctly. And that was done in conjunction with working with the FQHCs on that. This would, in some cases for the dually eligibles who are in managed care, this would bring us back to that process of having to wrap around and try to reconcile those payments, which will be even harder when we have Medicare as the primary payer. It's one thing if it's one of our managed care organizations where we have the encounter claims. It's a whole other thing when Medicare has paid the claim and we don't have any jurisdiction over Medicare and getting access to their source data for what claims they received, what they paid, and did that actually make it over to DHS. So that's just kind of a high level of the various buckets of concerns we've had, and we have been continuing to communicate with them around what possibly could be done.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, who knew healthcare could be so complicated? Mr. Chair. yes. Representative McDonald, Ms. Marquardt. I hear what you're saying, and I'm not sure that there's light at the end of the tunnel in terms of finding that path forward. I hope so. But I understand the issues that you're talking about from an administrative point of view, and yet how cool would it be for the FQHCs if we could figure it out, right? So I hope that there's some way to make progress. I hope.
All right. Other Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the department, to all of us, really. First of all, what is the right thing to do and what's right for the patient? I mean, if we're not able to provide the best quality of care of the patient because of coding or reconciling payments, that's absolutely unacceptable. We need to figure this out. That's all there is to it, so that we are providing the best quality of care for the people in need. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, I want to thank Dr. Price for coming and testifying, taking time away from your patients. I'm sure that that's hard to ever make that decision to do. So thank you, because we need to hear more and more stories about successes of care coordination. We can't hear it enough. It's an issue that we have not dealt with as a legislature, and we need to be moving in this direction and understanding policies that are going to help support care coordination so that we can get a handle on spending, get a handle on waste in our healthcare system. So congrats on great outcome.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also want to thank you for coming. And your story was quite moving. And I've said before that I am a big fan of the FQHCs and the work that's done. And I just sort of want to respond a little bit to it's unacceptable that we have to worry about that we have to have healthcare be so complicated when it shouldn't be about payment. It should be about healthcare. And I just want to sort of, although I don't think Ms. Marquardt needs any defense. She smiles through it all. We know that she does a great job, and it's certainly she's trying to explain the reality, and she's not creating the mess. It's just unfortunate that we spend so much of our resources and time figuring out who gets what from what bucket instead of just figuring out how to deliver the best care to people and save costs by delivering the best, most coordinated care to people who need it when they need it. So I just wanted to, thank you for coming in and also just to say that I hope we can figure something out. I hope that we can use the resources that we have right now as a state to provide care for people who need it. And it would be great if we could straighten out our funding streams so that they don't get in the way of actually providing that care. Thanks.
All right. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and not to get too carried away, but it does feel like we need some creative problem solving on this one, and I know that there hasn't been a hesitancy to, or at least there hasn't been increases in the manual workarounds that have been directed to counties in dealing with problems with the eligibility system and other components. And I'm sure we just haven't heard about it, but we haven't heard about manual workarounds that have been instituted within DHS, and maybe we're going to have to start looking at some of those kind of approaches for these things. There's not that many FQHCs around the state, and they really are the safety net. And as Dr. Price-Isuk testified, they have a new financial burden in that they are serving the underinsured, the people with high deductible plans that can't meet the high deductible. And we have the highest penetration in the nation, unfortunately, of those. And so we have a lot of working families who could only afford the premiums with a very high deductible, but when health issues strike, can't afford to pay their share. And that creates cash flow problems for these providers, and we need to really try and do whatever we can to step up. And if you could just remind me again, and maybe it's Mr. Watson, how many of these are there across the state?
Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Watson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, there are 17 federally qualified health centers throughout the state of Minnesota, 12 organizations in the metropolitan area, 5 in greater Minnesota. Combined, it's about 72 to 73 delivery sites throughout the state.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. When you consider the thousands of clinics that we have across the state of all different sorts, it seems like for these we ought to be able to find a workable solution, and I hope we do.
All right. Final thoughts, Representative McDonald.
Final thoughts is that Dr. Price-Isuk is doing wonderful work, as is Jim Platten and Jonathan Watson and Phil Griffin and all the folks that are doing God's work here at the FQHCs. I think that the Department of Health, Mrs. Marquardt, is going to work hard, and I think they understand the message here that we want to make sure that this gets wrapped up, and we sent a man to the moon with paper and pen
I think that we could have the good folks over at IT, Tom Baden, a friend of mine, and the DHS, come to a good solution for this. Mr. Chair, with that, I turn it back to you and ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. House File 711, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Bill. Representative McDonald, we also have House File 865, and I will make the motion because you didn't rank our committee high enough on your list of priorities requests.
Wow.
So you can't do that. If you're not here, because you didn't rank the committee high enough. So I'll have to go ahead and move 865 be laid over for possible inclusion. And I understand there's an A2 amendment, which I will also have to move, Representative McDonald. So all those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative McDonald, to your 865 as amended.
Thank you, Chair Matt Dean. Yeah, members, for 6 years I served on the Finance Committee, and it is true, somehow there was a clerical error at DHS, and I didn't get number one. No, just kidding, Mr. It was not DHS. The milk spilt on the form of priorities. Anyway, 851 is another great, beautiful bill that many of us in this room have been passionate about and supported in years past. What it does, it establishes a competitive grant program for funding.
No,
what this bill does, do you want to go to the amendment?
865.
Yeah, okay.
That was a totally different bill.
So that was another good bill, too.
Yeah.
It's going well.
Who's over there? Zerwas?
I got him off track. That's what I was.
Thank you. People with disabilities who want to live more independently should have the opportunity to do so. Wouldn't you agree? Our group residential settings, like group homes, do great work in the community. I know because in Delano there are several of them, one in which I was a board member for several years, and have a couple of cousins that are in that group setting. But we want to ensure that those who need more intensive services have them to be able to participate in them. And for those who can live more independently, then they have that ability to do so. That's what this bill does. I am asking for your support to increase the Minnesota Supplemental Aid Housing Assistance, an income supplement available to people with disabilities moving out of certain settings and paying over 40% of their income to housing costs. This proposal will have cost savings to Minnesota. I'll say that again, just because we're almost out of time. This proposal will have another cost savings to Minnesota, like my other bill, as if it was estimated $1 million per year cost savings to the income increase by offset of a reduction of the state funded services as they replace the federal funded supported services. I hope you followed that, because I didn't. Making this change will support more people with disabilities to live more independently, and it will also be critical for youth and others with disabilities to be more directly to move into their own homes, allowing them to bypass a group home setting when it makes sense for them. So here today with me to testify on this wonderful bill is Kelby Grovender from the Hearth Connection and Susie Emmerich Schatz of Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota. These two are doing great work on boots on the ground for the disability community. Mr. Chairman, I turn it over to you.
All right. We have Ms. Schatz from Lutheran Social Services. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Susie Emmerich Schatz. I'm here on behalf of Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota and the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. About a year ago, housing and homelessness advocates and disability advocates got together to talk about services for people with disabilities and some of the challenges that people with disabilities are experiencing in finding housing. And we found that we could address both areas through the proposal today, or this is one of the ways that we can address those challenges, by increasing MSA housing assistance and shifting the housing services that Mr. Grovender will discuss more to be federally paid. So MSA housing assistance is currently an entirely state-paid program that provides an income supplement to people with disabilities whose monthly housing costs are over 40% of their income. About 800 Minnesotans currently receive this $194 income support. Everyone receives the same amount. The proposal today would change the standard that's going to be used to determine that monthly amount to be about half of the SSI standard. So the new amount for individuals who qualify would be $367 a month. So that's a significant increase for those folks. To pay for this proposal, DHS would apply for Medicaid to pay for the housing services portion that Mr. Grovender will discuss. These services Minnesota has been providing for some time and have been entirely state paid. We were ahead of the curve on providing. But now Medicaid actually authorizes very similar services, so we're going to be switching those over. This proposal would automatically qualify individuals as well who are in a group residential housing setting, like a group home or another GRH-type setting, to move into their own homes. So they would automatically be eligible for that increased income supports. Increasing support, as Representative McDonald talked about, is a very good option, too, for youth in transition, youth with disabilities, so that they'd be able to bypass more of those settings like group homes. And we want to see more folks not even have to go into a group home if they don't have to, and be able to move directly into a less expensive setting like their own apartment. This is another way that we can kind of shift the ship of disability services as well. So thank you, and I'll turn it over.
Thank you, Ms. Schatz. All right. Mr. Grover, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Kelby Grovender, and I'm the Deputy Executive Director of Heart Connection, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to end homelessness in Minnesota. I'm here to testify in support of the 1959 waiver to provide housing support services to disabled homeless individuals as a billable Medicaid service. Heart Connection provides supportive housing to over 600 households across the state, representing over 1,300 individuals. Supportive housing is a recognized best practice in ending homelessness for those with multiple barriers to stable housing. It is the simple solution of ending homelessness by providing affordable housing combined with services appropriate to meet the needs of households who are not able to maintain housing on their own. Without housing, people remain homeless. Without services, these people are not stable and lose their housing if they have it. We are currently using state funding through the Long-Term Homeless Supportive Services Fund to provide a wide range of services to support our participants, including services described in this bill. If enacted, this bill would provide federal funding to leverage those state funds, allowing us to serve more individuals and bring us closer to ending homelessness in Minnesota. When combined with other Medicaid billable mental health services, such as targeted case management, we would be able to provide wraparound services to get people into housing and to prevent them from falling back into homelessness using primarily federal funding. A growing body of research shows that supportive housing can improve health and lower health care costs for people who face some of the most significant barriers to housing and health care. Minnesota could use its Medicaid resources more efficiently and effectively to address the health care needs of these individuals while furthering its goal of ending homelessness by creating a supportive housing services benefit. I've been providing supportive services for those experiencing homelessness for over 25 years, and I can confidently say that we know how to end homelessness. And it is through proven best practices such as supportive housing. In supporting this bill, you are supporting the end of homelessness in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grovender. Questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We didn't have an explanation of the amendment, which takes out the definition of segregated settings and our whole Olmstead plan and our compliance with the court order to move people from segregated settings to more integrated, independent living situations is totally based on this, and I'm wondering why this section was taken out, and because I believe that that's still part of our Olmstead plan and all the requirements that we've put together on that.
Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, Representative McDonald.
I think that Mr. Burke might be able to shed some light on this, as Doug, but also just to, it was a better nomenclature. Said he used the word segregated. No, Mr. Burke, okay, that's right. Didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I do have another question for you later. But if you need a better explanation, I think Susie can give you one.
Ms. Schatz.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. That's a great question. We had some concerns from the community about using the term segregated, and there was a request to switch it to the, I think it's licensed and licensed or registered. As far as the within the Olmstead plan, I would defer more to DHS on keeping those in a line.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we do need to follow up on this, and I think that we shouldn't be afraid to use the word segregated when it is. People only living with other people with similar diagnosis, I think that's just an honest term. And it's used in helping people individually plan, assess their options. I think sometimes in Health and Human Services we make it very difficult for people with disabilities and their families and care support to even understand what the professionals are talking about when we keep kind of recoding it into professional language. And people don't know what a registered is versus a licensed. And quite honestly, some registered and licensed places are more integrated in their programming, even if they might be segregated in their roommate assignments. And so I think we have a continuum of care, and I think our legal language and our bills should reflect that kind of person-centered discussion that I think we have committed to legally as a state. And so I think when this comes back, I hope that Representative McDonald and I and others can further discuss that, because I think we need to be transparent about what we're doing and what our goals are. I was also concerned about we're creating a new support service, which I don't have any problem with, except that we do refer to transitional supportive services, and then we authorize an ongoing support. And we know that many people will need help in that first year or two to explore their options, to talk about what neighborhoods they're in, are they comfortable taking the bus, what are they looking for, do they want to have roommates or not. And so they're going to need a lot of help in identifying the option and finding it and settling in and getting used to what their obligations are in a new housing situation. But the vast majority of them, probably after they've been there a year or two, not all, but the vast majority, are not going to need ongoing support services, coaching on being a tenant for the rest of their life. And I don't see in this bill any criteria by which, it says they'll be annually assessed, but there's no criteria by which they will be determined to no longer need this service. And in a budget that struggles in every area to even just get inflationary increases, we can't have people getting long-term support services who don't need it. And I think every time we authorize a new transitional service, we should put in law what our expectations are about transition and what and who falls between the cracks. Because there are some people who are unstable. They may be medically fragile in terms of being able to manage their medications or the progress of a disease or whatever. And so some of them are going to need probably ongoing permanent support. But we don't have anything in here that says how you would determine that either. And I think too often we open the doors to continual services for things we've passed while we still struggle to open the doors for or to support the services that other people are waiting for. So I hope that we can work on defining that, particularly on a new service like this. I think we should start defining what our expectations are.
Other questions from members? Seeing none, does anybody in the audience want to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative McDonald, final thoughts.
Final thoughts is just a brief story to put a human element to this. A friend of mine was in a group residential in Delano, and Tim Zava was his name, brilliant young man. And he was had an opportunity to get through the state law to move out of this group residential and be on his own. He fell in love, was able to move right across the street into the group home in his own place, and live a life, a quality of life like many of us in this room. God rest his soul, he died last year of cancer, and he had one of the biggest funerals in Delano. He was one of the most beloved figures in Delano. Tim Zabel had a mind greater than those I'd met in my life. Remember every sports statistics from the NFL to the NHL to the Delano Tigers and Watertown Mayor Royals. He had such a great mind. Now he's at work up in heaven. But it gave him an opportunity, because this program, what this bill will do, to move out of the residential group home setting and be on his own and have a great quality of life.
fall in love, get married, and live life abundantly. And I didn't even mention what Mr. Grovender did, the homeless, being able to house the homeless. We're doing good work here, and I ask for your support in this bill, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Representative McDonald. And with that, House File 872, as amended, is laid over for possible... Excuse me. I'm sorry. I read the wrong one. 865, as amended,
I did that too.
Laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Thank you to the testifiers and Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
So, members, our next meeting will be Monday, March 6th. And that will be at the call of the chair after session. So pay attention to your email. That's correct. The amendment deadline for that will be 10 a.m. on Monday. We'll be taking up House File 5. So if you have an amendment to House File 5, 10 a.m. Monday is when we'd like the amendment. And pay attention to your email. I don't like anyone else on the floor, so check it out.
It looks like that. We are adjourned.